Okay, this is Karen Brewster, and today is September 19th, 2018, and I'm here with Roy Nelson for the Skagway Klondike Gold Rush Historical Park Oral History Project. And we actually are in Fairbanks at the moment, as Roy is passing through town on his way out of state. So thank you, Roy, for finding time today to meet with me.
You're welcome, no problem. Appreciate you getting a hold of me.
Well, a little investigative work. It's actually thanks to Doreen, because yeah. Carl contacted her and we traced you down. So just to get us started, you were born and raised in Skagway?
Yes, I was.
Tell me about that.
My dad came up to Alaska during World War II with the Army, helped build the work on Alaska Highway, and he got transferred to Skagway when the Army took over the railroad to work on the railroad. And in the meantime, before the end of the war, my mom, my oldest sister, were already up here. So after the war, he stayed with the railroad until he retired in 74. And I was born in Skagway at the old Skagway White Railroad Hospital.
White Pass Hospital.
White Pass Hospital. And 1956, and so I was just pretty much born and raised, grew up there, pretty much spent my whole life there. I took two summers, and I came up here in 95 and 96 to work on building the Alaska pipeline. But outside of that, most of my life and my work experience has been in Skagway.
Okay, and you graduated from high school,
yes.
Skagway High School?
I just graduated from Skagway Public High School in 1974.
All right. And so when did you start working for the park?
I started in January 1979 with the Park Service. I'd been working construction, and one of the guys I worked with in carpentry was a friend of Pete Bathurst, who was the... I don't remember what his exact title was, but he was like in charge of stabilizing and starting the restoration on historic buildings. So he offered me a job to come in January to help start stabilizing the Lynch and Kennedy building and doing some other maintenance and everything.
And do you remember when the park started to form and the idea of there being a park established there?
That was probably, I would say, the mid-70s. I mean, it didn't, as soon as they, the president at that time, you know, it was 40-some years ago.
Right,
I
right.
I don't remember everything.
But no, but I just remember what being in the community, do you remember what it was like and how people felt about there being a park there?
Some people were against it. A lot of people were... A lot of people were for it, a lot of people were against it. It was kind of split, you know. A lot of the old-timers and a lot of the younger kids my age that were born and raised there were kind of against it because they knew it was going to take their freedom away from just going out and four-wheeling and die and cutting wood wherever they wanted and doing things that they were able to get away with.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, a lot of the restrictions and everything, which comes about with becoming a park.
Right.
You know, federal rules and laws.
Right.
So, you know, when I first started working for them, there was a little bit of animosity between me and some of the people I grew up with and knew because they kind of thought me as a traitor.
Yeah.
Because all of a sudden here I'm starting to work for the government and the Park Service.
They were the enemy.
Yeah, well, so. You know, they just didn't understand what it was about. Nowadays, majority of them people have turned around and realized that the park was good for the city, especially once the railroad stopped shipping and all the freight and the ore stopped going through. The park helped bring the tourism into town.
Mm-hmm.
And tourism is Skagway's bread and butter now.
Mm-hmm.
You don't work unless it's... Somehow you're always, you know, you're involved with tourism, you know, like after I got done working with the Park Service, I went to work for the city Public Works Department. It's those tourist dollars, tax dollars that pay and make the city budget, you know. And so with that, you know, the city has gotten money to be able to build up the infrastructure, a new clinic with some grants, a new fire hall, police department. They're redoing the streets, or planning on redoing the streets. Put a lot more people to work, you know, and grant you, majority of the work in Skagway is seasonal.
Right.
You know, because once a glass cruise ship leaves, everything shuts down outside of what needs to be around for the infrastructure.
Right.
But, yeah, you know, I had a hard time with a lot of my friends when I first started working for them. To them, I just say, hey, it's a job. I'm not wearing a uniform, not wearing a badge. I'm saving these old buildings that are part of Skagway. And throughout the time, you know, people learned to accept it. And then, you know, like say after the railroad shut down, the park did start doing a lot more full-bore local hire, with especially like the restoration crew and all, because a lot of guys that worked for the railroad came to work for the park, and a couple of them have actually retired from the Park Service.
Right. Yeah, because the railroad shut down in, what, 82?
82, and didn't reopen until 96, I think it was.
Yeah. And, yeah, the same skill set would apply for the maintenance and construction kind of jobs. Well, given that your friends, when you were growing up, were sort of against the park, why did you decide to take that job in the first place, if you were kind of already...
I had no desire to work for White Pass. You know, I mean, it was too... I saw kids, you know, got out of high school, or even quit high school when they turned 18 to go to work for White Pass because it was good money and everything, and they got really dependent on it. And it wasn't... I just didn't have the desire to do that. I wanted to work my hands. I wanted to work construction. My dad was a carpenter. He taught me how to pound nails. And he never pushed me or anything to go to work for White Pass.
But it was a good job for him?
It was a good job for him, you know, back then, yes. You know, and he, like I say, he worked with White Pass from after the end of the war until 1974, and he retired like 2 months after I graduated out of high school.
Mm-hmm.
But he enjoyed it. I just wanted to do something different.
Right. And what was your dad's name?
Art Nelson.
Art, okay. And what about your mom?
My mom's name was Mary Melise, but she passed away when I was 8 years old.
Oh. Did you have a stepmother?
I had a stepmother, Mary Nelson, who my dad married when I was like 13, 14. So he went, you know, for quite a few years, mm-hmm. being a single parent.
Yeah.
And raising myself and my sister, who's still alive, Doris.
Mm-hmm.
And my older sister, Ethel, she already had a family of her own. My nephew, Mackie's only a year and 9 months younger than me. So we grew up as brothers.
Yeah, cool. So when you first were working for the Park Service, you started on that historic building restoration, right?
Yes.
So can you tell me about that, what kind of things you were doing?
Well, the first project was the Lynch and Kennedy. And they had it totally gutted out, and they had trusses and frames on... big scaffold jacks that we were leveling and because the building was about ready to fall down, so we were actually stabilizing it.
Okay.
And we lifted it up to the height they wanted it, brought it up another 4 inches, and the next spring we dug and put a foundation underneath it, and then sat it back down on the stem walls, and then, you know, in the meantime, had to assist her and replace a lot of the rotten studs and everything, because The set bottom floor was totally gutted out. The second floor was intact. In fact, that's what they used to lift the building with, was the second floor.
So what was it sitting on before you put in the new foundation?
Just dirt and you know, blocks and pier, just like all the other, all the buildings were. There was no concrete foundations in the older buildings.
Right.
Because they were built back in the Gold Rush era, or right after the early 1900s, and they were put up quick, so... And they used concrete up back there,
right?
Especially up here,
right?
We're up in Alaska, so or in Skagway, so
right.
Most of the buildings, you know, were that way. So we were at that time. We were in a more of an aspect of stabilizing and leveling the buildings, as far as restoring, you know, doing the total restoration on them. Because we started on that, and then. The next summer, summer of 79, we started on the Mascot and the Railroad Depot, which is now the headquarters of visitors. So my job the first year of summer I was there was just crawling underneath, digging little trenches, jacking buildings up, cribbing them, getting them level.
Wow.
So a lot of belly crawling.
Yeah. Were you the young guy on the totem pole, so that's why you got to do it?
No, I mean, I was working for him, and I knew what I was doing, you know, because my dad was a carpenter, and I'd helped him out throughout the years doing stuff like that and leveling buildings. So I really wasn't. I couldn't really say I was a young guy because we didn't have a full-blown crew yet. We hadn't. There was myself, and then... Don Corwin was there by that time, who was the millwright. And
what's a millwright?
he built all the doors and windows and all the trim, you know, reproduced everything. He worked in the, well, before we had the wood shop that we have now, we used to use
I have the map of all the buildings on Broadway. Will spark your jog your memory.
Oh yeah, I'm just.
You've been out of it a little bit for a couple of years.
The Pantheon.
Okay.
Yeah, I didn't even look at that. I remember that. But when we first started. Our wood shop was a little garage up over by the Pinal Mission. That's where Don and I worked.
Okay.
And he worked pretty much through the whole until 99 when we all got RIFT.
RIFT, the...
Reduction in force. They got rid of by that time we were turned. Before that, we were just seasonals. And they were working like... year-round, getting two-week furlough.
Right.
And then once they did the, once that 1,039-hour act came in, they had to turn all the people that they wanted year-round into either permanent or put them on terms instead of making them permanent, because I think the way they had it set up, there was a goal, and so the whole project of the guys that were working there was supposed to be done by October 1999. And so they had a term, and I had my last few years, I was on term also until 1999. Then we all got RIFT.
Right.
And then so, they started bringing in new people after that.
So it was a funding issue or?
It was just the way it was set up with Congress for the budget, you know, when they first bought the, when they first made the park. They set aside X amount of dollars for each building, and they figured out, you know, they figured how long it would take to restore them. Well, their estimates were way, way off.
Yeah.
Because you just don't go in. It's not like new construction. You just don't throw it up. It's, it takes a lot longer to restore a building than it does to build a new one.
Yeah. And so I was wondering when you, you know, lifted up these buildings for stabilizing, did you find things down in the ground below? You said your wife's an archaeologist, so...
Yeah, they were monitoring it a lot, especially if we tore out the floor. They'd go in and dig first, you know, and do their field work and their field testing and everything. And then if we were digging, my wife Doreen or one of her employees would be monitoring as we were digging. And if we saw anything, we'd have to stop.
Right.
And but they were pretty thorough, you know. And so, you know, every now and then we'd find something they overlooked because they hadn't dug quite as deep or in the spot we needed for, mm-hmm. you know, we needed to go to.
Yeah, because I was thinking in all those old buildings, there's stuff under the floorboards or still in the buildings, maybe, artifacts and things.
Oh, yeah, we found Jeff Mall and I one time, we were working on the old Moore house. We were stripping the siding off, and between the first and second floor, because it had been added on like numerous times, there was a little gap. And we pulled this one board off, and there was a bundle of tied up letters, love letters from Jack Kermsey to his girlfriend down in California.
Yeah.
And as soon as we saw them, we stopped. It was on a weekend because Jeff and I were working overtime. Got one of the historians and my wife, Doreen, called them in. You know, we didn't touch them. And they got them. I think the park still has them in their archives, all the bundle of love letters.
Cool.
When he was a kid.
Ah.
And Kermsey was the owners of the Moore House after Ben Moore sold it to them. You know,
okay.
Kermsey's Carryalls, who goes back to the Gold Rush, Kermsey. And,
yeah, it's a big Skagway name for the business of jewelry and curios and things, right? Yeah.
Yeah. So.
And he grew up there. Jack Kermsey grew up there?
His... Jack did, and it was his dad that started the business.
Okay.
And
so
he came up, I think he came up when he was a young kid.
But the love letters were from Jack.
Yeah.
Cool.
And I can't remember the dates on them or anything like that, because I never really messed with them.
No, but it's fun to hear about the kinds of things you might find in all these old buildings.
And of course, you know, like a lot of the areas when we'd start stripping off the interior, there'd be graffiti. People would write names and dates of stuff, you know. And so we found a lot of that. And then once we got, we'd stop and then they come in, the archaeologists come in and photograph it and everything. We wouldn't touch it. We just covered it back over.
Oh, okay. They didn't, like, take out those boards and...
No, because usually they were on, like, the siding or part of the building and the structure itself.
Yeah.
And we'd try to, if we had to take them off, we'd mark them, you know, and protect them and put them back in the same exact spot they came from.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember any of that graffiti, what it said?
Oh, there were some names and dates, and then in the... In the railroad depot going up the stairwell from the visitor center area up to the office, there was quite a few derogatory statements about Mike Haney, the builder of the railroad. In fact, some of them I don't even want to say aren't recordable.
Okay.
They're blank, blank,
right.
Mike Haney, or
right.
Mike Haney is blank, blank.
Wow.
And then there was a lot of names, you know, people just, guys working on the building, all just sign their names and put the dates on them. And, and we even did that in all of the buildings. When we finished, we'd find a closet or something, and before we cover it up, we'd put like the day of the calendar or the day on it. We'd sign stuff and put it in. So whenever they're restored again, there's another time capsule from the restoration crew from the Park Service
that's
that worked on them.
It's cool. It kind of reminds me of the tradition of, like, iron workers, you know, they put up the flag and at the end, or they sign their names, I think, on the last beam or something.
Yeah.
You know, that's neat. Follow that tradition.
So, yeah, we always did that with all the buildings. And, I mean, after I didn't work all the time on restoration. I was also on the trail crew. And so there was years that I didn't really start or complete the buildings, so a lot of them I didn't get involved with.
Right. But as you say, that when you first started doing that in the 79, it was just to stabilize the buildings, and then later that it was much more restoring, preservation.
Right.
Did you work on any of those?
Oh, yeah.
So how did they decide what it was supposed to look like?
They took... pictures and photos from like the early 1900s is basically what they were based around. And of course they took paint samples, and so everything was repainted to the original first color.
So the buildings were still in good enough shape that there were still paint.
Majority of the buildings had been used. There was only three or four that had sat unused for any amount of years. A lot of them had been used right up until when the Park Service purchased them as one thing or another.
Right.
So, yeah, they were, you know, like the depot, you know, that hadn't been used, but it had up until the late 60s when the railroad built their new depot. The Pantheon was used in the 70s. Lynch and Kennedy off and on. The mascot was used as housing and other things. I mean, a lot of it had been shut down, but it was still being used. There was still people living in the Morehouse.
Oh.
There was always people in the the Pinal Mission, because it was basically turned into a private home.
Oh.
Before the park bought it.
Oh, I don't know. That must have been big.
It was.
I'm going to just pause for a second. Okay. So, like you mentioned, the Pantheon, what was it used for? Was it originally a saloon in the Gold Rush days?
Yeah, it was actually, the saloon was next to it. It was a dry goods store and various other things, I do believe. The historians and all, and like Doreen would know more.
Oh, yeah.
About,
I was just wondering, you know,
year-to-year basis, but
what you remember from when you were growing up there, what these different buildings were used for.
Yeah, when I was a kid, it used to be called the Brownies Bakery. It was a bakery.
Oh, okay.
And in fact, the back part, they had this big oven in it that we had to take apart to even get out of it when the park bought it. And then it was a carryall store after that. And I think it was owned by Jack and Margie Brown. And then I think they had a carryall store and a little clothing store in there. And then the last owner was Marie Kallstrom, who I don't know if she really, because that was about the time I was kind of gone working up here.
Mm-hmm.
If she really did anything with it, she might have just bought it as an investment. But it had been used up until the mid-70s.
Mm-hmm. And then like Lynch and Kennedy, was that always, isn't that kind of the hardware store?
No, Lynch and Kennedy, it probably was. I don't really remember because that was one of the buildings that actually sat dormant for quite a few years.
Okay.
When I was a kid growing up, it was used. It was probably when I was real little, so I don't really remember, but it was pretty much an abandoned, closed building because mm-hmm. it was one that was in pretty bad shape when we got it.
And then what was the other one you mentioned? Well, the Moore House you said people were living in. What was the other one you mentioned?
The Pinal.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, that was the old mission.
Yeah.
And people were living in that?
Yeah, it was a house, you know, mainly a private home.
Yeah. Seems like a big house.
It was, but, hey. Probably was cheap back then.
Yeah, you needed housing. So when you were a kid, did you say these abandoned buildings, did you guys go mess around in them? And
most of them were locked up pretty good. We got into a couple of them, but we were pretty much told not to, you know.
And you listened?
Well, kinda. Sometimes.
Yeah. Think for a kid living in Skagway with all those old buildings and history to poke around would be enticing.
Yeah, we checked them out, but a lot of them were, there wasn't really anything in, they'd been cleaned out.
Oh, yeah.
You know. The mascot, I do remember when that was, they had, I think they might have had a little store downstairs at one time when I was a kid, but when I was growing up, the upstairs was like housing and I don't know if the company owned Golden North actually owned it, but a lot of the employees would live over there upstairs. because they had like apartments, and especially like where the news depot and all that is. That's the next building to it. And then the cribs, the verbal Wheaties, that was many different things. It was a, they had a gas pump out there at one time. It was a liquor store. It was a travel agency, housing, home.
Wow.
You know, I mean, and it was used up till it caught on fire.
And which building is that?
That'd be the Verbal Wheaties confectionery. That would be right. Right here, Verbal Wheaties confectionery.
Figuring out how to spell it. Oh, Verbal Wheaties. Okay, I never knew how to pronounce that. Verbal Wheaties. Okay. Cool. And so, yeah, so you said you raised the buildings, you put foundations under them, you cribbed. The cribbing was for the raising?
Yeah, raising and hold it in place until we put a foundation, put any, you know, redid any of the structural work we had to do to set it back
up. How did you raise it? Did you use...
Well, some of them, like the Lynch Canyon, we gutted out, and same thing with the Pantheon, but a lot of them we just cribbed and jacked because of the floors and the floor joists and everything were solid enough to be able to do. So we just crawled underneath with hydraulic jacks and set them all up and go down lines and jack up, you know, make maybe an eighth of an inch at a time and doing rows back and forth until we had it level enough to the height that they wanted it at.
Yeah. As I say, did you have a guy on each jack? Okay, go.
You had a line. And sometimes when you were by yourself, like I was quite a lot, you'd go up one line and back down the other and back up. Wow. And then shoot grade on it and see where you're at and see where it was high or low. And
I'm surprised that it's an old building that jacking at different levels, that the framing could withstand that, that the walls and the roof wouldn't collapse.
If they were solid, you got to look at this as old rough cut timber, and it was all mainly fir, and it was all straight grain, tight grain, tight knot, so it was hard. Because sometimes you had to cut a piece of it, you'd have sparks coming off the blade of your saw because it was so hard of wood by that time. You know, there'd be rot around maybe at the base or something where it was in contact with the moisture, with the with the ground, but otherwise it was solid.
Wow, that's pretty amazing that all the way. Yeah, I would just think everything would twist and shake and the floor would get all wonky. Yeah.
Well, you know, you just wanted to get up because you weren't worried about cracking anything because it was all going to be restored, and 90% of the time we took all the windows out first.
Okay.
And the doors, you know, just plywood over the entryways.
So where did they get fir? Did they bring all that wood in?
Well, it was brought in and it was milled around Skagway, you know, because Skagway wasn't always all cottonwood. It was all evergreens. There was very few deciduous trees there. And I'm talking old growth, big trees. Because
right.
They had, during the gold rush, if you take a look at pictures, all the mountainsides are clear cut.
Oh, yeah. But wouldn't that have been like Sitka spruce and hemlock and things?
But there's fir there.
There's fir there too? Oh, okay.
But there, you know, a lot of it is spruce, but it was old growth and tight, you know, tight grain, so it was just as hard.
Right.
And especially after sitting there for 100 years.
Yeah, cool. The other thing I was thinking is like, you know, not thinking, well, cribbing up a building, like just take a crane and lift the whole thing up, but you guys couldn't do that?
No. Well, first of all, we didn't have the equipment, and it's just not the way you do that, you know. I mean, you got to bring it up, and then, like, two of the buildings, the old depot and the mascot had rock foundations underneath their safes.
Oh.
And so that's what we brought the level of the building up to, because the buildings had sloped away from the safes. So we just jacked it up to that elevation, and that's where they're at. That's the reason why, like, the the old depot is so high up in the air because that's where it was originally.
Oh, and then everything sank, but the rock and safe area.
Yeah, the foundation underneath, because that's a two-story safe. And
oh, really?
Building. Yeah, there's one downstairs and one upstairs right there.
Right, on the same...
Yeah, above each other.
Vertical, yeah. Huh.
And so there was no way you're going to do anything with that.
Right.
So that's what we we leveled it to that, and that's why today when you look at it, it's 2 feet higher than the rest of the buildings and the streets because it was built that high originally.
Huh. I didn't think about that. A big, heavy safe would need something underneath it other than just a wooden floor.
No, they're
they used rock, huh?
Rock and mortar and concrete, you know, and made a big base underneath it.
Wow.
So cool. That's where that was the goal, to jack it up to that. That's what we did.
Ah, cool. So let's talk about the Choker Trail and your work over there for a little bit.
Okay. I started on Chilkoot in 81 in the fall with Jerry Watson, who was the trail foreman. He came up, and then that fall I helped him out because he lost his crew. And I got to liking it because I'd done the Chilkoot when I was a kid. Quite a few times I used to trail guide. And so we were pretty good friends by then. And next year he asked me to come back. So I started on the trail. And we were totally rebuilding the trail because nothing had actually been done on it since the late 50s, early 60s when the state... Department of Corrections had crews up there. They built the old log cabins and the shelters and everything. So it had been quite a few years before it had any real maintenance done on it.
Mm-hmm.
And the trail crew before us that the park had put up there had really much, pretty much just surveyed it and laid out the route, did some temporary trails and, you know, temporary bridges and all. So we started actually physically building all the bridges.
Wow.
And I, in, let's see, 81, 82, and 83, I worked on building the two big suspension bridges up there. I was in charge of that. I had my own crew doing that. In fact, that was where I got my first achievement award from the park for. I built one over in Canyon City from trail over to the Canyon City Historic Island. And then I built the other one up at 11 Mile.
Wow.
And one was 68 foot and the other one was 74 feet long.
Wow.
Never built a suspension bridge before.
Yeah, so how did you do that?
Well, it was a kit.
I mean,
it was a package thing. You know, everything was done by hand, digging the holes for the anchor blocks for the suspender the suspension cables. We had a 1 yard gas mixer that we mixed everything by hand, wheelbarrowed it, or poured it in place. Got all of our aggregate we dug out of the rivers and wheelbarrowed over it into place to mix the concrete.
Wow.
So, yeah, it was all done by hand. That's why it took us 2 years to complete them.
And then did all the supplies and stuff get hauled in on your backs?
Oh,
you helicoptered them?
We helicoptered all of that stuff in because it was some big beams and everything and a lot of concrete. Because most of the time when we had to fly in, if we didn't use on-site material, we'd sling load it in. And they still do that.
Yeah. So how many guys on your crew?
I had 4 guys on my crew, and Watson had 4 on his crew for about 3 years. And then we went back down to a 4-man crew. Because while I was building suspension bridges, he was building the other log bridges and the other footbridges.
So it was 5 guys, you and 4 other guys?
No, myself and 3 other guys.
Oh, you and 3 guys who built the suspension bridge?
Yeah.
Wow.
And every now and then, you know, Watson's crew would help out when we were doing a lot of the digging or hauling the materials. But, yeah, it was mainly a 4-man crew.
Wow.
Myself and 3 guys.
It's like a lot of work.
It was. But I was young. I was still in my 20s then,
yeah.
So it didn't faze me.
It must not. I mean, you said you never built a suspension bridge. And
well, you know, I'd had some architectural training in high school. I went through mechanical drawing architect class because I was really good in math.
Mm-hmm.
So I knew how to read blueprints and everything.
Oh, well, that's
good. Plus, for my experience of working construction, I knew how to read blueprints. But it was a kit, so I mean, it was pretty much just had to figure out what went where and put it together.
Well, but still the foundation and digging the mm-hmm. with all that material and stuff.
Oh, yeah.
You had to figure all that out.
Yeah. But I had, you know, like, say, over my life as a kid and everything, working with my dad and all my construction experience, I had that pretty well figured out. Because
mm-hmm.
I also, you know, and like I say, I worked up here on the pipeline. I was on the lower end crew laying the below ground pipe the first year. And the second year, I was insulating the above ground pipe. And then when I left there, went back to Skagway, I was a pipe layer laying the new sewer service system in Skagway. So I knew how to shoot grade. I knew elevations. You know, I could do it.
Cool. And then did you and your crew camp up there all summer?
Yeah.
While you were working on the bridge?
Yeah, we had, we worked, that time I think we were working 4 days on, 3 days off. Then we eventually went to 8 days on, 8-10s, and 6 days off. So we weren't spending so much time traveling.
Yeah.
We built a base camp, a trail crew base camp, just above Canyon City. In fact, we even, same thing, we, at the end of the day, we'd, when we first were up there, we just had tents and a 12x12 lean-to tarp for a kitchen. So every night on our way up, one guy would, we'd clean our packs out, one guy would take all of our gear, and the other three guys, or however many guys were there, would take a gunny sack with a garbage bag inside, fill it up with dirt, with gravel out of the river, and hike it straight up the hill up to our camp and dump it off till we had enough materials to make concrete.
Oh.
Because we kind of did it on sly. I mean, it was approved, but it wasn't approved, but we wanted to get it built. I mean, it wasn't in the budget.
Mm-hmm.
So we just started doing it on our own.
Wow.
And then it got approved, but you know, I mean, we were all young, and a lot of the guys were young and in good shape.
Well, you'd have to be.
Because I had a lot of the guys were ex-military, first few years, I had a lot of Vietnam vets working on the
mm-hmm.
trail crew.
So when you started, the years on that bridge were 81, 82?
I'd been 82 and 83,
okay.
I do believe. And they're still standing, but I think the one at Canyon City, they're thinking about having to replace, but, you know, they're over 40 years old.
Right. And they're made out of wood?
Yeah, they're treated wood.
Yeah.
They're still, you know, I mean, it's taken quite a few hits from floods and everything. I think they've, from what I understand from the trail crew, they're up there now that I kind of, every now and then I talk to them when I see them in the spring, because mm-hmm. Kat always tells me what's going on, you know, and because she knew I was one that started
right.
rebuilding the Chilkoot. And she was telling me that they were thinking they're going to have to replace the one at Canyon City.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I mean, that was 40 years ago
yeah.
that those were built.
It's amazing. And so what other kinds of things did the trail crew do while you were working
well,
with them?
Well, we built all the bridges from trailhead all the way up to the summit, which was like, I can't remember now, 60 of them, I think. You know, some short, some long. Some we did on-site material. You know, I cut big timber. We just drug them in, and we winched in big rocks around the abutments and all mm-hmm. to keep them from washing out. Rerouted quite a lot, you know. Of course, then the annual stuff of brushing and everything. We redid We replaced, moved Pleasant Camp campground higher up from where it was because it was washing out and flooding. Helped build the Ranger, new Ranger station. Built the new campground at Canyons or at Sheep Camp. Cleared a bunch of avalanches. The trees had gotten knocked over in the winter from snow avalanches.
So that was probably every year you had to clear out?
Well, the avalanches, we only had a couple of them, major ones that really knocked down a whole lot of trees and covered a lot of the trail, and that was all above Canes, or above Sheep Camp going up towards the Scales, mm-hmm. where the big avalanche was back in, during the Gold Rush.
Right.
Then we had beavers move in to the lower part, and I started building the boardwalk through the beaver pond.
Do you remember when that was?
See, that would have been a year or two before I left off the trail crew, so that would have been 70, probably, or not 70, 95 maybe, 94, 95.
Okay.
Because the last 4 years, from 94 to 99, I wasn't on the trail anymore.
Right.
So it had to be, I think, 92, 93 was when we started the...
Okay. So, yeah, because the notes I have from Carl said you were on trail crew from 80 to 95, but
right.
you're saying 81 to 94?
Well, 80, actually, I was kind of on the trail crew in 80, but that's the year, that fall is when I started.
Okay.
That summer, I built the ranger station out in Dyea at the Dyea campground.
Okay.
They had two tent frames. I framed them in, put roofs on them, and then I built another sleeping quarter cabin. And
that was in 1980?
Yeah.
Okay.
And then 81, no, that'd have been 80, that'd been 81 when I
okay.
did that.
Okay.
Because 80, I worked the whole summer
doing the restoration.
Restoration.
Okay.
For the whole year, actually.
Okay. So, and then after, so then that would be summer of 82, you went out on the trail itself.
Right, yeah.
Okay.
That was my first full year on the trail crew.
So the beaver pond... That area where the boardwalk is, I've walked that part of the trail.
I guess it's gotten a lot bigger.
Yeah, so before that, that was not all water?
No, that was dry.
Wow.
Then the beavers moved in and started damming a couple of sloughs, and we come up there one spring, and there was water on the ground. We bushwhacked around and saw this little beaver dam, and it just kept growing. So they had... Up till then, there hadn't been really any beaver around that area for years.
And the decision was, do you know why the decision was made to just leave it and do the boardwalk instead of going in and destroying the dams?
First of all, you can destroy them, but they're just going to build them bigger and better, like the $6 million man. And they are natural. It is their... used to be part of their natural habitat, so we couldn't destroy them or remove them.
Okay.
You know, I mean, that was just...
So beavers had been there historically, and then they were just coming back.
They were hunted out, and they moved. You know, they weren't as many down there as they were, like, up in the Yukon, you know, on the other side of the border, on the other mm-hmm. side of the passes. But they had been down there. Just not in quantities, but the park just couldn't do any. You know, they're not going to hunt them, they're not going to trap them, relocate them. Just got to live with them.
Right. That's a lot of boardwalk that you put in.
Yeah, but it's also made a great wetland ecosystem in there now. Last time I was up there, there was blue heron in there. A lot of, you know, of course the fish love it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a lot of wild waterfowl. They're coming back. Ducks, Lujan's. So, you know, I mean, it's just part of nature. It's part of the life cycle.
Right.
Taking back what was theirs at one time.
But so I can imagine building all that boardwalk and those bridges through there. Were you doing it in waders the whole time?
Sometimes, yeah. I mean, that boardwalk was actually real easy to do. It's just two planks side by side on a crib.
Right.
You could go through and we made it so as they build it up higher, you could take it apart and add another layer of cribbing.
Right.
And just keep raising the...
Because, the water, as you say, it may be higher now than when you built it.
Yeah.
And they just can keep raising it.
So, and it's gotten longer, you know. I mean, excuse me, I got to stop for a second. But, that was... from what I understand, it's almost up to the sawmill now, which is quite a little bit of area. But what they're going to do with it, I have no idea, or, you know, how they're going to deal with it, because, well, I don't work for the park
right.
anymore. And it was a good idea to start with, because we didn't think they were going to get that big of a group of them and start building that big of a dam across there.
But, right.
Because we tried to knock holes in it. That was somebody's great idea, not ours. Because I tried telling them, they're going to have this rebuilt in a day, and it's going to be bigger and longer and everything. They cut out a couple little spillways to try to drain the water off. Sure enough, 3 days later, we hiked back out to it, and it was like a foot higher and probably about 20 feet longer than what it was before.
Yep.
And they weren't just cutting down... The beavers just weren't chopping down a little alder and little small saplings. They were actually chewing down big cottonwoods.
Wow.
I saw one cottonwood that they chewed that was probably a good foot in diameter.
Wow. That would take a little bit of time.
A little bit of chewing, but soft wood, too.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
But, yeah, I found their beaver dam on the other side of the slough against the bank, and it's... That time it was probably off the side of the bank. It was probably a good 5 foot high and probably 12 feet long.
Wow.
And going up the bank about 6 feet.
And they're serious.
They were moving in.
Yeah. back other trail crew things. I don't think everybody realizes how much work goes into building and maintaining a trail. Like that.
There was a lot, you know, especially when we were there, because we were, it was pretty much restoration, restoring it and everything, and a lot of manual labor, a lot of wheelbarrow work, of course, a lot of hiking. Everything was done by hand. You know, and while we were building, like, we did on-site material, you know, we peeled the logs, we notched them with a chainsaw and an axe. We cut the deck out of them, like notch them and level them, or we had 3x12 cedar flowing in, and we cut deck for them.
Wow. Yeah, you didn't. Did you have one of those sawmill attachments for your chainsaw to make them boards?
No, we didn't want to do the logs, because most of them we used the big logs on were a long span, like 40 feet or so. You know, I was cutting big timber.
Yeah.
We didn't want to damage the integrity of the log by cutting into it. We just level a flat plate off of them and then put boards over them, or we cut them down just enough to make a deck out. We wouldn't cut them in half or cut them down, because that just weakens them, especially where they're green.
Mm-hmm. So, man, those must have been heavy, big green trees like that.
Oh, yeah. I had a portable... winch I ran off a chainsaw.
Oh, right.
An old leany winch, and I just winched them in place across the streams and up the other side, and between winching and rock barring.
What's rock barring?
It's a big bar you use for like moving rock and everything. You have to use it sometimes if the log dug in, you know, you have two guys on either side with these big bars to lift up.
Oh, right.
I put a point in them. but they'd lift them up, get them out of the, from being dug in, and I'd start sliding them, and they'd put roller logs underneath them. And
you mean like corduroy to push the...
Well, yeah, but they were just like round, just a section of log, you know, small four-inch log you put underneath, just like rollers,
rolls
like
it
a
over.
Piece of pipe.
Yeah.
Keep it rolling. But yeah, it was very physical. You know, and we had some good, healthy guys on the crew.
So the route for the trail, you said, you know, you were restoring the trail because it hadn't had any maintenance. Is the route, was it obvious? You know, and it's not exactly the same route as what the gold miners used.
Oh, no, it's been totally changed. There's only a few sections is the actual historic trail, and that's out of Canyon City going up to about 10 miles. The southern part, the first hill, the Saintly Hill, the state put that in, and then after you drop down there at mile 1.5, the trail is an old logging road that went up to the sawmill up at 4 Mile.
Mm-hmm.
And then it actually goes all the way up to Finnegan's Point, because they logged that area back in the 50s and 60s.
For the sawmill.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that was all, most of that trail is the old logging road. The original trail didn't actually hit that side of the canyon until up above Finnegan's Point, which is still, actually, I'll take that back. There is still some of the historic trail above Finnegan's Point up to 6 Mile. It's been moved around so much because of either flooding or alluvial fans moving. What we did was we tried to stay with what the state had put in the 50s and 60s as much as possible. But, you know, there's areas you couldn't do it because it was either underwater, washed out, or it was a bog, you know, quagmire, so we'd have to move it. We moved it up to drier areas.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of that was just for safety of the hikers.
Did you have to cut a lot of brush for...
Oh, yeah, we did a lot of brushing. We did hours and hours. And I mean, it took us probably 2 or 3 years to totally brush the whole trail out. Brush it back, and then you had to brush it annually.
Right.
Because we used to have one or two of the guys, especially where in the real brushy areas, that was pretty much all they did was brush, at least for a part of the season. And we always, all four of us, you know, in the spring, we'd brush anything that was down over the trail, cut it out, you know, and brush back on our way in and out, or way up in the spring. And we'd take sections, and we have two guys to a crew because you didn't want to be working by yourself with a chainsaw.
No.
One guy cut and one guy pulling brush, and you'd switch off. And so, yeah, you know, I mean, it's constant maintenance.
Well, that's what I was wondering, you know, by 95 when you stopped doing trail work, was there still a need to constantly do all that brushing?
Constantly doing all the brushing, you know, every year that something would happen, you'd have to do a reroute, there'd be a bridge taken out by a flood or snow or something. Always maintenance on the campgrounds and the buildings. So, yeah, there's always a need for trail crew.
So tell me about some of the buildings and the campgrounds. I haven't been to those campgrounds, so are there actual little cabins or wall tents for the rangers? Or
well, they have a ranger station up at Sheep Camp, which, because the rangers, you know, especially with the weather, is bad weather, they have to hike up to the top of the trail to the summit, to the Canadian border, and then the wardens come down just to follow people up, make sure they get up safely and don't get lost or hurt.
Mm-hmm.
So their base camp is in Sheep Camp. Trail Crew's camp was outside of Canyon City. Canyon City had the old log cabin warm-up shelter that the state had built, and the rest of it was tents. And then when we moved the campgrounds from Sheep Camp out, because they were actually on the historic part over artifacts and old buildings, we had to remove that. We moved it south, and we put in two semi-walled tent frame warm-up shelters, and then you know, a couple, two or three tent platforms, and the rest are just campsites for tents. And last year, from what Kat was telling me, the cabin, the old log cabin the state had put in up at Kane City really wasn't being used because it was an historic site. They rebuilt a cabin down in Skagway last year and put it together and took it apart and flew it up. Yeah. And we're going to reassemble up there in Sheep Camp this year, from what I understand. And that was, when I talked to her, that was in April before I left, and I haven't been back, right. So I don't know.
But that would just be so the Rangers would have a little bit more of a place to...
No, this is for the hikers.
Oh, for the hikers.
It's a warm-up shelter.
Oh, so the hikers could get out of the
shelter,
weather.
Yeah. No, the Rangers have a brand new... Well, it's an old, you know, it's not brand new now, but we built them a new station in mid-90s, I do believe. You know, fully heated, you know, propane.
Wow.
The only thing they don't have is running water.
Right.
But they got the river right there. And they have sleeping quarters, bunk beds on one side, and there's the upstairs attic is kind of like a storage / extra sleeping area. And that's their office and their shelter and their cook, you know, their kitchen and everything right there. Ken Russo was the actual carpenter that built that. He worked with us with the trail crew building that.
So what did you do in those early days in terms of communications? Like you said, Jerry Watson's crew came and helped you. Did you guys have radios?
Yeah, we had two-way radios.
So. And they worked out there?
Oh, yeah, because those were repeaters. So they worked pretty good. You know, there's certain areas... Couple spots, if you were real down low, they wouldn't work originally until they got stronger towers, but you just had to hike up out of the hole you were in, and you could get communication. Yeah, we all carried radios.
And then did you communicate back with folks at Skagway?
Yeah, we could communicate with anybody on the trail, the office, the Canadian wardens, and, you know, so we always kept talk to each other and knew where everybody was and what was going on. And
so was Jerry considered the head of the trail crew?
He was a trail foreman.
Trail foreman, yeah. Okay.
And I'll give you his number and all.
Okay.
Yeah, he was there for 14, I think he was there like, well, he was up there until 90, I think 98 was his last year when he couldn't do it anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Because in 99, my last year, I actually did restoration and I ran the trail crew.
Wow.
I'd work 6 days down, or I'd work 6 days up on the trail crew. I'd come back. We worked Wednesday to Wednesday. I'd come back and I'd work Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday on restoration. Then I'd take Monday and Tuesday off and I'd go back up.
Wow.
I did that for that summer.
And you were the foreman that summer,
yeah.
But you still went out on the trail. The foreman still works out on the trail.
Yeah, working foreman.
Yeah.
And we'd pretty much, you know, I mean, I was down to one guy at that time, and so we didn't do a whole lot of construction. It was more just the regular maintenance, you know. I mean, I built one bridge, small bridge by myself, did one little reroute. But it was mainly just being up there doing maintenance.
Oh, like what?
Brushing, had to dig a couple outhouse holes, flying stuff in and out when it was needed, keep an eye on people.
Well, I was wondering in all those years that you were out there on the trail, from, you know, 81 to 95, or 99 maybe, did you notice a change in the usage of the trail and the hikers?
Yeah, I mean, when it first started up there, it was more experienced hikers, you know. Used to be a lot of Europeans and all, and some groups. the better the trail got and the more popular it got, it definitely got more, because we wound up now where you have to have a hiking permit, and you know, you have to let them know where you're going to stay at, because each camp can only hold so many people.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and of course, the Canadians have, you have to pay to go into Canada. Now they have a hiking permit and a paid permit.
Oh, so you have to get the Park Service permit, and then you have to get a Canadian permit if you're going to do the rest of the trail?
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't know that. But when you started back in 81, was there a need to get permits for the hikers?
Not really, because there wasn't that many of them, and it wasn't that big of a deal. And then, of course, Parks Canada, you know, they're not like the Park Service here, where they get money from Congress, you know, we get a budget. They actually have to show up. They have to make their own money.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Per se, you know, they got to have a certain amount of income.
Mm-hmm.
The Canadian government does throw in money, but
right.
They have to do something to it. So they start charging for hiking permits. And plus that helps track where people are, how many are on. And I can't say about now, but I know there's more and more people going up and get a lot less experienced hikers, because now they think, there's people up there, it's this nice, easy trail. It's not easy.
Mm-mm.
I don't care how well we maintained it and got it fixed up. It's still a tough trail, especially once you get above Sheep Camp.
Yeah, well, the step section sounds rather intimidating.
Mm-hmm, it is. I've had a few people freak out up there.
And is that even really trail, or it's just...
It's just rock,
it's
you
just
know.
Rock.
I mean, you have cairns along it to keep you where you're supposed to be going and where the trail is, kind of, so you don't get lost.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, once you get up there, and the safest route, too, of course.
Right.
You know, because it'll change from year to year.
Oh, really?
Well, it depends on what happened, if there's been an avalanche or...
So the trail crew will go out and remark it in the spring?
Well, the rangers do that,
okay.
Rangers and the wardens, because they're the ones that go up. Our job mainly was always up to timberline, you know, because there wasn't much we could do anything outside of the up there, you know,
okay.
Above there. Because it's whatever Mother Nature does is where...
Right. Well, I haven't been up to that point on the trail, but I read that they, from not only do they have, you know, rock cairns, but they would paint like orange triangles or something. Do they still do that?
I have no idea.
But did they used to do that?
Not really. We tried to get away from that because that's just kind of obtrusive.
Yeah. You know, when I read about that, I was a little bit, that doesn't sound like the Park Service.
No, I mean, I don't ever, unless it was just for emergency reroute around something or something like that. They always tried to use cairn, something natural. just like if we flagged anything, you know, as soon as we could take the flagging down, we would.
Yeah.
But, because, you know, I mean, you're out there, you want to experience nature.
Right.
You don't want to see this modern paint and plastic hanging out.
Yeah. So did you ever have to help any hikers? You know, you said, like, the rangers go up to make sure people get over the pass, and I'm sure they've had to rescue people. What mm-hmm. about you?
Oh, yeah, we have. We've had a couple of incidences down in Sheep Camp, but, you know, we always have checked on people. Like, if we were, whether it was foul, we were around, like, Canyon City, excuse me, you know, we check in on Canyon City because that's 5 miles for the rangers to have to come down every day. You know, we did some first aid, some splinting ankles and all. We had one guy chop the end of his finger off, and we got him out of there on a medevac. But down in the lower part, we really didn't have that many serious injuries. Our biggest thing was, a lot of times I'd come through camp or through Canyon City, and you could tell the inexperienced people, because they just bought all this stuff from Eddie Bauer or North Face or something, had never set their tent up before, had never put their camp stove together. It's pouring down rain. They're wet and tired, and they're sitting there trying to figure out how to put a tent together. So I'd show them.
Oh, that's nice of you.
You know, I'd put their tent up for them and say, watch. And, you know, sometimes there were tents I had never dealt with before, but I put enough tents up, it was easy enough for me to figure out.
Right.
You know, next time I would have done it, it would probably take me a quarter of the time it took the first time. But, you know, we always did that and made sure everybody was okay and warm and nobody was hypothermic. And, you know, our job really wasn't to take care of the hikers, but it was part of our job. I mean, it was still part of our responsibility to assist.
Well, that's kind of what I ask about it. It's like, yeah, officially, you weren't there as support, but
no.
If something's happening, you know, you're not going to walk away,
No, we can't. You know, we had to take care of it.
And then on your crews, the trail crews, were there times where people got injured?
Not really. We were always really safe, you know. Like, I did the all the chainsaw instructions and safety instructions with the chainsaws, how to run a chainsaw and how to use it and everything, you know. I mean, that was, we got new guys on, I trained them. I did the same thing with the Rangers because they really didn't use chainsaws, but for a while they were when they had to cut their own wood and everything. But I, you know, they just had a small one, but I was in charge of the training. Of course, I did all the maintenance on the equipment and all.
Right.
But we always seem to get pretty savvy guys up there for the crew.
Good, because you're kind of far out there if something major happened.
Yeah, no, sure there was a few bumps and bruises and stuff like that, but never anything that involved a medevac or anything.
And now when you were a kid growing up there, you said you kind of went up the trail. Was it used by people?
Not real often. There was a lot of times in the fall, people would hike up. There was a family, their name was Nelson also, not related to me, but he had a hunting and guiding, because he had horses and all, and he'd go up to Canyon City and go up to Norris and all, goat hunting and bear hunting, and take people up. There were certain groups, people still used it. What I did when I was like in my teens, I used to work for the state of Alaska Department of Juvenile Corrections. And, well, I didn't work for them, I kind of contracted with them, and I'd take a couple groups of kids over every year that were in trouble, but, you know, not hardened, kids. You know, kids that had a little run with the law or on probation or something, and I'd work with the probation officer, Neil King, who's gone now, out of Haines, and he'd bring like a couple groups a year over, and I'd do the guiding for them because I was their age, and so it was kind of like a thing to show them, you know, what they could be like, I guess, you know. And then I used to do some for like Boy Scout groups and Girl Scout groups. I never took like a group of just individuals over, you know. I was never into the Sherpa Packy, you know, type of groups that we have now. But I do, sophomore, junior, didn't really do it my senior. I think my freshman, all through high school, basically, I'd do like anywhere from 4 to 5 hikes a year up over the trail to all the way into Bennett.
Go up to Bennett and then take the train back.
So, yeah, it was a little extra income for me. It was something I enjoyed.
Yeah, well, it's interesting that the Department of Corrections had that idea to bring kids over there.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, nowadays, it's a very in thing, you know, the taking kids out into nature and reconnecting, and that can be very healing and helpful.
Yeah. Well, Neil, he was, you know, like I say, he was from Haines, and he was an outdoors guy, and he believed in it.
Mm-hmm.
And so we hooked up, and so, you know, he just kept using me until I quit doing it when I
started
working.
Where was those kids coming from? An Anchorage facility?
Pretty much southeast. Oh. And they weren't from facilities. They were kids that were just, like, did something stupid. They weren't like, in detention centers or anything. They were just kids that either had a, you know, from messed up families or, you know, did something stupid, like getting caught drinking or doing drugs or maybe petty theft.
Uh-huh.
And what the whole idea was to stop them before they started doing some really violent crimes.
Right.
You know, really getting behardened.
I was just wondering how they found those kids and brought them together. They must have...
Through the court, you know, the through court, juvenile.
Yeah, sort of like being sentenced to community service. They
yeah.
sentenced to...
But it was they weren't made to do it. It was okay. something they it was voluntary on their part.
What a great experience for them, though.
Yeah. And that'd be like anywhere from my average groups were like 15 to 20 people. And they had always had made sure they had good equipment. We'd meet at my house and my dad's wood shop, and I'd go through their packs, show them how to pack them. And, you know, some kid might have a whole bunch of cans of Beanie Weenies. Like, no. You're not going to make it far with them. Here,
right.
Just get you some dry food. You know, of course, the state supplied most of it.
Right.
And I did the same thing with the other groups. You know, I checked through, and then we, you know, I made them break up the meals. So, like, you're packing breakfast tomorrow for everybody, your lunch and your dinner. And,
right.
Set it up like that, you know. The kids enjoyed it. And so, you know, I mean, and then, of course, the Boys and Girl Scout groups, you know, I took over were pretty good. I used to have more problems with the adults than the kids.
Because you were, is this because you were a teenager yourself, or you?
No, the kids, you know, sometimes I'd get adults that, you know, oh, it's wet, I'm tired, my feet hurt. You know, the kids, they just like, yeah, okay. Basically, you know, but most of the kids, you know, I mean, most of the people, even the adults, were experienced enough, and even though they had never done the chokehoot and everything, and it was just a safety factor for them to have somebody that knew the trail.
Right.
And knew where to go, because like I say, a lot of times, bridges would be washed out, you had to know how to bushwhack up around, find a place to forge the streams.
Yeah, because in that... This was in the 70s, right?
Yeah.
So the trail wasn't obvious in places like it is now.
It was pretty brushed in. There was a lot of places. You know, a lot of the bridges were damaged. And, you know, because the state really hadn't done anything since the early 60s. The only maintenance that was kind of done was, like, from Wes Nelson, who did mm-hmm. the guiding up there. And I think the state forestry did a little bit of work, but they never, you know, it was like, couple people would come up for a week here and there, you know, every summer and do a little bit, but there was never actually any trail maintenance done until the Park Service took it over.
Yeah, well, since, you know, nowadays everybody's heard of the Chilkoot Trail
yeah.
because, you know, the park, and it's advertised and it's so popular, but yeah. back then, if it was sort of grown in and not so used, how did people know about it?
Well, a lot of it was from history, you know, because... You know, if you ever study Alaska history or, you know, U.S. history, you're going to hear about the Klondike Gold
right.
Rush and the Chilkoot Trail. And there's always been that picture around that
staircase.
Line of ant-looking like line of men going up and over the Golden Staircase and all.
Right.
It's always been, I think, a fascination to people. Yeah. It just wasn't very popular because it was hard to get to.
Right. And, you know, you did mention before how Skagway now has, you know, become such a tourist-based economy. But there were tourists coming through all along.
Oh, yeah, there have been tourists since the Gold Rush.
Right.
But not as substantial. I mean, when I was a kid growing up, you had the Princess Pat, the Prince George, with the two main cruise ships. And, they come in once a week.
And they were small.
They were small.
Right.
You know, and then you get a few other little ones that come up, but nothing like nowadays when you got four big 3,000 people ships coming in docking and
right. And at one point there was that Golden Circle route that the tour companies kind of promoted. And I don't know if that went through Skagway. I can't remember. That was like in the 40s, 50s, 60s.
Yeah, it did. I think it did. Most of the people, you know, because that time they really didn't have a lot of tour buses going up because the Alaska Highway was dirt and rough. And so most of the time the ships that came up then were affiliated somehow with White Pass. So they'd come up and go up on the White Pass and either go up to White Horse, because that time the rail, the train went all the way to White Horse.
Right, and then they would take the boat down the Yukon.
That was in the 50s, and then they, you know, when they still had the river boats going.
Right.
In the 40s and 50s. They stopped that, I think. Like I say, Jerry would know more about it than I do. She knows more about the history than I do.
Before we get off the guide, I wanted to just follow up on a couple questions about the guiding. Why didn't you continue into the guiding business? It sounded like you enjoyed it. Or did you not?
I enjoyed it, but, you know, I mean, at that time, I didn't see any future in it because they really hadn't started. You know, that was before, right when I started finishing up, that was right about the same time Klondike Safaris came into effect in Skagway. And Skip Burns was the owner of that, and he did the guiding over the trail, and then the river raft, you know, river rafting down the Yukon to Dawson. And he was into it. I was doing it because I enjoyed it, and it was something to do. But you know, I never foresaw it as financial or business venture. I was young, you know.
Right.
I wasn't thinking about being the age I am now. I wanted to do something different. I wanted to pound nails and dig ditches, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But I did it because I enjoyed it, and it was a good opportunity. And, you know, yeah, I made not big bucks, you know, but I made some money off each trip, you know.
Yeah.
Usually about $150, which for a 14-year-old is pretty good money for 4 days.
Yeah. So why did you stop working on the trail crew and go back to restoration?
I started, you know, my knees were starting to go bad by then, or I was starting to feel it. My wife, you know, I mean, we were doing it, plus the restoration was year round.
Okay.
The trail crew was, at that time, was seasonal. It was 1039.
Okay.
And, you know, so even if I worked there, I couldn't go back on restoration.
Oh, because you'd done too many hours in the year.
Because, you know, that was after. And they, you know, that time they made them term, so I decided, okay, I might as well get in there and get a little, you know, some of the retirement and insurance.
Mm-hmm.
For a few years. Yeah, because
seasonally you don't get any of that.
No. And I just, you know, 14 years was enough.
Yeah.
And I wanted to, you know, because I really enjoyed the restoration part, too, you know, because I'm a carpenter and all, and I like to do that. And it came up, and I took it. Because I could have gone into the maintenance department quite a few years before that. But I was single. That was before I met Doreen. And one of the guys that was on the trail crew, Pat Moore, John Warder was our boss and chief of maintenance. He offered me the job with maintenance, you know, the maintenance part of the park. And I was single and I was still into doing the trail, and I turned it down, told him to give it to Pat because Pat just got married and they were expecting a baby. So he gave that job to Pat, who's gone now. He passed away early 90s from ALS.
Mm.
But I'm enjoying what I'm doing. I'm happy, you know, so I turned it down, which I shouldn't have, but I did because I didn't really need it that time because I was also working. If I wasn't working for the park in the winter, I had my own little business going on doing plumbing and carpentry and all, you know, doing little repair jobs and I did a lot of plumbing because I was the only plumber in Skagway.
Yeah, so seasonal work for the Park Service wasn't enough to live off of all year round.
Not really, and if it was, I wasn't sitting around doing nothing.
Yeah.
I'd rather be doing something, you know.
Yeah.
But, so, it was, you know, you could, but it was pretty tight.
So most people did something else.
Yeah. And a lot of kids, you know, a lot of people that were the seasonals, which was mainly the trail crew and the rangers, were had another job or were college kids,
mm-hmm.
going to college.
Well, they went someplace else in the winter.
Yeah. But, yeah, so.
So, yeah, so you were the first, is that right, that you were the first local person hired by the Parks Service?
Actual local person. There was people that were hired before me that had been there. You know, they had a couple little projects going on. But as far as a resident in Skagway, yeah, I was the first actual local resident to be hired.
Wow, pretty cool.
Yeah. I just took it because I had no inclination I was going to spend that long with the park. I just got offered the job for the winter.
Mm-hmm.
The construction job I was on finished in December. Well, in fact, I could have gone before that, but I told Pete, you know, I need to finish up with this construction company. We were remodeling the old high school. And I said, as soon as I'm done, yeah, I'll come to work. So once we were done there, you know, and I got laid off from the construction company I was working for because we were done, I went to work for the park. And, you know, I hadn't planned on staying with them. I planned on just doing it for the winter or something and going back, you know.
And then
the construction began, but.
Since you were hired as a local, since then, do you have a sense of how much there's continued to be local hire?
Well, like I say, right after the railroad shut down, they pretty much supplemented a good majority of the restoration maintenance crew from people from Skagway.
Okay.
They gave them a local hire preference.
Right.
And a lot of guys stayed, like Dickie Brown, who was there. He worked up until 99 with the park. When we all got ripped, and he went back to White Pass, which he could have done year before when the White Pass started back up,
mm-hmm.
and worked for White Pass for another 3 or 4 years to get his retirement from White Pass. But he waited until he got done with the park before he went back to work White Pass. And then another guy, Mike Collier, he came to work, and then he advanced on. He went to Harper's Ferry and got restoration training and all, and then he wound up over in Glacier, Montana, and I think he's retired from park now. And of course Andy Byerly, who was same thing, you know, when he left White Pass and they shut down, because he was a carman, he used to work as a helper for my dad when he was young. he just stayed on with the park and retired from the park.
Right.
And there's a few other guys that worked off and on a few years and moved on, you know, but those three guys, they pretty much stayed with it.
And Cy Dennis, he's worked for the park.
Cy,
I don't know if he worked for White Pass.
Yes, he worked for White Pass. He was at the ore terminal on Longshore.
Yeah, and his dad, obviously.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right, Cy.
Yeah.
He's still working. I think he's got another year or so, I think, before he retires. Same thing, you know, they all got hired when the railroad shut down.
Right.
And they stayed.
Yeah. No.
And any one of them could have gone back to the work for White Pass as soon as they reopened. They didn't.
Mm-hmm. Well, you say you didn't expect to stay with the Park Service as long as you did.
No.
So why did you stay?
Because I enjoyed it. I enjoyed what I was doing, you know. I mean, just like I say, I love carpentry, and I really got into restoration instead of new construction because it's totally different. It's interesting. It takes patience and time, and got to know what you're doing. It's totally different than throwing in up a new building.
Uh-huh. With the restoration, are there things you had to learn specific for restoration?
Well, they had trainings for different things, you know, all the way they want stuff painted and how to refinish stuff, how to strip it. We learned bricklaying. A lot of it was general carpentry knowledge, of course. And then I learned from Don, with helping Don, you know, how to rebuild doors and windows. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking, is that it might be more interesting because it's more challenging. You're learning new things mm-hmm. than just putting framing up all the
yeah,
time.
Yeah, or you know, going to Home Depot and buying a door and a window and the siding and all the trim. You rebuild everything because it's got to, you got to duplicate what it what it was for that area, that time period you're rebuilding, you know, restoring for. And then, you know, I mean, then I got to enjoy the trail crew because I loved the outdoors. I loved hiking. I always did that. When I was a kid, I used to take off and just go up the mountainside and camp. Me and my dog Yogi, I just tell Dad, I say, okay, Dad, you see that cliff over there? I'm going to be up there tonight, you know.
Cool.
I'll be down tomorrow.
The benefit, benefit of growing up in a place like Skagway.
Yeah.
You could do that.
So, you know, I mean, it just, after I started working for the park, the that style of work and ideology started appealing to me.
And you were, how did you feel about working for the government in a bureaucracy? How did that work with
it
your
style?
It never
bothered me. I was never, you know, I mean, I wasn't, I knew what was going to happen. You know, I could see the writing on the wall before I went to work, you know, for the park, you know, how things were going to change in Skagway, but there was nothing anybody could do about it. It's there. Got to learn to live with it and accept it and work with it, you know. And the park did, has done a lot of good for the community and for people in town.
Mm-hmm.
And I just, no, I never had any problems with it, you know. I mean, it took me a while to get used to the bureaucracy.
Yeah.
You know, all the paperwork or, you know, like, okay, this has to be done this way because this is the way it's written down, you know. It's like, so, you know, it took me a while to get used to that part of it, but I, you know, I learned it. I learned to live with it.
Well, as you said, with your example up on the trail, well, we couldn't do it this way. We just did it our own way.
Yeah.
Yeah, the Alaskan way.
Yeah. Well, you know, we had pretty much, because, you know, they had no, like with the restoration, you know, it was all blueprinted out and everything from Denver.
Mm-hmm.
So you had to follow them. And then if you had to do a change order, if all of a sudden it looked like it wasn't going to work, you had to get a hold of them and get their blessing to do an as-built. Where up there, we just, each fall when we submitted our budget, we just put our projects for the next year and, you know, what our goal was to get done for the next year.
Mm-hmm.
And it was never any drawing out or, you know, getting permission to build a bridge this way or whatever. It was just, it was what our goal was for the next year and how much it was going to cost and man hours and materials and stuff like that. And they just let us do it.
Yeah. I would think at the restoration, you say that, okay, now we got to get permission. And did that stall projects? And was that frustrating?
Well, to some of the guys, especially the guys who's in charge, you know, but, yeah, it was, but you learn to work around it, and normally we could see it going to happen in, early enough in the progress to be able to address it before we got to that point.
Okay.
And either get changed or, you know, get the, as-builts or change orders, and that didn't happen very often. They were, the, architects and engineers at Denver Service Center were pretty good. We had some good guys. And like, majority of them all spent time up in Skagway when the park first took over and were going, getting ready to restore the buildings. They pretty much all of them had come up and went through them and worked hands-on to physically see what
mm-hmm.
what was going on, what needed to be done and everything. And they come back here, you know, from time to time. Like, we had this one guy, Dave Snow, who was the project architect, and he lived in Skagway for, he came in, I think, right after Pete Bathurst left. And they, him and his wife and two kids, they lived in Skagway for quite a few years before he went back down to Denver Service Center.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a nice guy, you know, he knew what he was talking about. He knew what he was doing. He could work with his hands. He just didn't he wasn't just able to, you know, he wasn't, he was, he could do more than just draw it on paper and say, here, this is what it's supposed to look like.
He had the practical hands-on experience to translate.
And so did Pete Bathurst and a few of the other guys. Some of the other guys after that were the same way. And once the ball really got rolling and the building started being worked on, they kind of pulled away and then left the restoration crew to do it. And of course, we've had some good hands like Jeff Mall, who was the last head carpenter, lead carpenter. He still lives in Skagway. He was really good. Yeah, I mean, that guy could do anything with a piece of wood.
So how many people might be on the restoration crew each summer? I assume you only did it in the summer. Did you do that? Oh, no, you said that was year-round.
There was normally 4 to 5 people year-round, and then they would hire sometimes laborers and all in the summer, depending on what they were doing.
Mm-hmm.
If they're doing excavation or, you know, groundwork, they'd hire more seasonal people, just guys to...
Mm-hmm.
Use a shovel,
right?
You know, but because normally it was like you know, when they first started, they had a lot more restoration crew. You know, I mean, like when we did the old railroad depot, I think there was 12 of us, but they were also doing, there were aspects of the other buildings going on at the same time, especially like stabilizing, getting roofs on, getting them weather tight and stuff like that.
So you might be working on multiple buildings in a season.
Sometimes at the beginning, yes, and then the last I'd say the last 10 years it was individual buildings. But yeah, because the big goal when they first started was, like say, getting them stabilized, roofs on them, getting them sealed up,
right?
And then they started their going to, you know, restoring each building as they went. And like when one was getting close to being done, and a couple of the guys on the crew would stay back and do the finish up work, and the rest of the crew would start on the next one. Like when we did the my first one after I actually got on the full time crew was the Moore House.
Mm-hmm.
And so towards the end, it was Dickie Brown and I that stayed back and like did the flooring and the trim work and did all that, while the other crew, it started on the Pantheon by that time. The tearing down what they needed to, digging, stabilizing. Because that was the actual, because we used the Pantheon, like I say, as a wood shop and everything up until they built the new shop.
Right.
Which they didn't really build until there was like 3 buildings left, 4 buildings of all the buildings. They finally got it built.
So do you have a favorite building that you worked on?
Moore House.
Why?
First of all, it was my first, well, I liked them all. I liked the depot too, but that was one of the buildings they pretty much had to take apart and put back together.
The Moore House.
Yeah, and everything we took off, that building is like 90% original. From the flooring, to the wainscoting, to the trim. I spent 3 months, 1 winter, doing nothing but stripping the paint off of all the siding, the wainscoting, the trim, you know, over and over again, just this big circle. And of course, it's lead-based paint, so I had to have all the suit on, the respirator. This was in the Pantheon after what used to be the wood shop part, but had plastic on the floor, the wall, the ceilings, a plastic double through doors. Nobody could come in without suiting up. So I was in there basically by myself for 10 hours a day just doing it. And, oh, I was never so glad to take vacation. I mean, it was monotonous. But it was interesting to do, but it was very meticulous work.
Yeah.
So, yeah, from the aspect of doing all that, I think the Moore House was one of my favorite ones to work on. Because I started from start to completion.
Yeah, you got attached to it.
Yeah.
In a way.
And like I say, I don't know if me or Dickie was the last one to drive the last nail in it, but it was one of the two of us.
Cool. So how do you feel when you go and you walk around Skagway and you see these buildings that you helped restore?
Proud.
And what about the trail, that work?
Oh, I'm proud of that, too. And people still talk about it, you know. And the trail, like I said, the trail crew nowadays is always telling me, you know, how great our work was and how it's still doing. And they'll still ask me advice and stuff like that.
Or do they say, why the heck did you do it that way?
Like, you built stuff last.
So just to finish up, you know, you left the park in 99 mm-hmm. because you had to. Or was it your choice to go do something else?
No, we got riffed and put some feelers out, Doreen and I, to different parks and everything. But we never really got anything back. And then So I had my own business going on at that time. We both did. She was doing archaeological contract, and I was doing maintenance and plumbing in Skagway. And then, so I put in an application with the city of Skagway, the Public Works Department, because they were, you know, hiring. And I got hired on there in 2000. And, you know, the guy I worked with, my boss, Grant Lawson, I grew up with, you know, we were kids. He's a year older than me, so we knew we'd known each other pretty much all of our lives. He came to Skagway, I think, when he was about 8 or 9. And we never really got anything that response from any of the other parks that we wanted. And plus, we were getting older, so there was the age factor.
Mm-hmm. Well, and you have a long connection with Skagway. Maybe you wanted to stay there.
Oh, I was willing to move. I really didn't want to, but, you know, if I wouldn't have gotten a job with the city and I got offered a job with a park someplace else, yeah, we would have gone.
Yeah. So what kind of things did you do with Public Works?
Well, I was in charge of the streets, which I was in charge of all the boardwalk. You know, Broadway, all the signage. I did all the concrete work. I did their sewer and water installations and repairs. Did garbage. Did, you know, a little bit of everything.
Snow plowing?
I didn't really do any of the equipment stuff.
Okay.
Because my vision and all, I just wasn't comfortable with it. Did all the maintenance, you know, on buildings and everything. I was their carpenter,
Okay. Basically
a maintenance guy.
So was that wooden boardwalk that's now on Broadway?
Mm-hmm.
Has that always been there since you were a kid? Or
no, it used to be, when I was a kid, it was all concrete. When it became a park, they tore out all the concrete and put boardwalk back in to make it historical.
Oh, okay.
And
but then you had to maintain it. The park didn't maintain it.
No. The city
put it in.
The city put it in. The park maintains, like, the boardwalk around the visitor center, around the Itchen House, or part of up to the Itchen House. It's kind of a joint thing around the mascot. And then, where the Morehouse is now, and they do the boardwalk off of the 6th or 5th Avenue into theirs, and around the back, around the old buildings and all, they have that little turfed exhibit walk. They do all that. But any of the other boardwalk, I maintain and rebuild and everything. In fact, when they started doing a lot of that stuff around the Morehouse and all, they were coming over to me and asking me how to do it, because I rebuilt. With the city, I'd rebuild an average of, depending on the weather, first of all, when we get into it, because you can't put it down when the ground's frozen. It's got to be thawed to be able to compact and stay where it's supposed to be. But I always shot from anywhere from 600 to 800 feet of boardwalk. And that's, you know, not only Broadway, that's all the avenues with right. all the boardwalk, down to the City Hall, down the McKay Building. So, yeah, I pound a lot of nails on
so
that boardwalk.
A lot of boardwalk. And then you said you couldn't work on it in the summertime.
Not too busy. Too many tourists. And in the fall, we always seem to be, that's when we did a lot of the water and sewer services, because that's when people would start, companies and people would want to start building or redoing something, so we'd have to get their systems in because they had to be done before the ground froze.
Right.
And then in the spring, you know, it was boardwalk and repairs on other stuff. And
well, you mentioned before we were recording about one of the things you got called to do with the boardwalk was when a tourist dropped something down through
the boardwalk.
Through the
yeah.
boardwalk. Did that happen a lot?
Yes. Yeah, you know, some days, there was days I'd get called 3 or 4 times. Sometimes it would go a week. It all depended. And normally, like I said, it was in the afternoon after they'd done with all their tours. So they're all down on Broadway, you know, all 10,000 of them. Doing their shopping, they're buying their trinkets and jewelry, and somebody would drop something down, either a piece of jewelry, a credit card, something that wasn't just a little five and dime trinket they didn't care about or wasn't worth pulling a board for. And so I'd have to go down, and a lot of times I was able to get the little pinchers and get it out, but 9 times out of 10 it hit and rolled underneath the board, so I couldn't reach that way without popping a board up. And like I say, as soon as I did it, it was like a car wreck. Everybody was over to see what I was doing. And then they all wanted they want to take pictures of me and all doing it and afterwards. And the toughest part was, especially if it was something expensive, they'd want to give me a reward or a tip for doing it. And I can't, you know, I was just like with the park, you know, I was a public servant, so I can't take utilities.
Right.
And especially the foreign people, it was really hard explaining to them, they really couldn't speak English, that I couldn't take it, you know. And sometimes they almost got offended, you know. And luckily there was always somebody in a group or somebody around that could speak their language and explain to them that I just legally couldn't do it.
Right.
So I got to a point where I just tell them, well, if you want to do something, almost every local establishment, the restaurants, the grocery store, the liquor store, there's, you know, any of the clubs, and some of the businesses have donation cans for different things like Paws and Claws, the animal shelter, or somebody's sick, or cancer awareness. Just throw some money in there.
Right. Well, that's what I was going to ask, is could you take it and not keep it, and
take it. I just tell them, go drop something off.
Yeah.
And, you know, I said, you know, there's plenty of them around, do whatever, you know, but if you feel like, you know, because I said, I'm getting paid to do this. I'm not pulling this board out of the kindness of my heart. I'm getting paid to do this. And if it was after 4 o'clock, I was getting paid overtime to do it.
Well, and you say for tourists, it's a novelty to see somebody come and pull up sidewalk to help them, you know.
Of course, then, especially the little ladies always wanted to get a picture of me after I rescued whatever it was they wanted. And so I got my picture. It's probably all over the world.
Probably. And you said, you know, with all that foot traffic there, you kind of have to block things off so they wouldn't.
You'd try. And they'd still go through. And normally I always try to get have one of the other guys with me to run interference, but a lot of times it'd be after hours or nobody would be available, so I'd have to do it. And like I told you that one time I was nailing another board down. I'm left hand, so I had my right hand out but next to the building with the big picture window, and this lady slides through to look at something in the window and stands right on my hand. I had to ask her, please get off my hand. And I've almost nailed a couple people with my hammer on a backswing because they walk up right behind me to see what I was doing.
Yeah, and you don't know they're there.
So, yeah. But in that aspect, I'm glad I don't do that anymore because, you know, I got frustrated. Of course, I had to be nice to them because I am a public servant.
Mm-hmm.
Or was a public servant, you know. I can actually say what I wanted to say.
Yeah, and as you say, the tourism's the bread and butter of the community, so you do have to be careful, probably.
Yeah.
And so you retired in 2016 from the city of Skagway?
Yeah.
And now you're just volunteering as a carpenter.
Yeah, basically. Yeah, I spent the last 2 years in BLM up in Coldfoot, so Drain. And next year, we're not sure if, when I was talking to Bill when you mm-hmm. came up, if he did get that money for the interpretive display they're doing up there on the mining around the Coldfoot area. Drain was kind of involved with it, and I did some work on the cabin display and everything they have. So if they get some money ahead, we might come up for a couple months and work on that.
Cool.
But right now, it's all up in the air, you know. I mean, it depends on families and family health. And
right.
We feel like doing next year.
Yeah. Well, it's great that you're still involved and contribute. You know, you want to contribute. And
oh, yeah. I just want to sit around and do nothing, you know.
Yeah.
You know, I'm retired. It's nice not to have to get up and go to work every morning at 7 o'clock in the morning and be there all day or,
right.
you know, from Monday to Friday and stuff like that.
Or be out hiking on the trail every day in the rain.
Yeah. But at the same time, I want to stay active.
Yeah.
I don't want to just sit around and do nothing because I've seen that happen to too many people and they don't last that long.
Right. So anything else about the restoration or the trail or growing up in Skagway that you wanted to talk about when I mentioned about doing this interview?
No, you know, I mean, I just wanted to try to remember, you know, give you names of some of the people that you might want to try to contact.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how to, but, you know, I'm sure Carl can come
right.
up with that. That information. Well, I guess, you know, I just want to say that I really enjoyed the 20 years I worked for them, even though it wasn't full time most of the time.
Mm-hmm.
I got a little stipend of a retirement from them, but not much. But
right.
and that was my own choice at the time, you know.
Yeah. Well, not everybody can say that they 20 years that they enjoyed with the same employer.
Mm-hmm. And no, you know, they treated me good, you know, and I was always doing some, you know, a lot of stuff was repetitious, but each building was a little bit different. Was, you know, everyone was a different challenge, the same way with the trail, you know, everything was a little bit different challenge.
Mm-hmm. Now, were you with the park, there was that, was it in the mid-90s where they had sort of this big administrative kind of kerfluffle? I don't know the right word. Where, with the there was superintendent left. And
oh yeah, yeah.
Were you there at that
yeah.
point? Did it? I don't know exactly what happened. And
That you know.
Or if that affected you.
No, see, Clay left, and then it didn't really affect us that much because you know ours was. We were pretty much, the restoration crew was pretty much run by Denver Service Center. You know
okay.
what I mean? And the chief of maintenance in Skagway.
Who
I mean,
was?
That was John Warder at that
okay.
time. John was there for quite a few years. Before John came, we went through chief of maintenance quite often. About every year for quite a while, we wouldn't have anybody. And or, you know, they come for a season and decide they didn't like it there, move on. Or one guy even went home for vacation and never came back. he hated Skagway so bad.
Wow.
He's from Texas. But, you know, that he was a nice guy. He just, I don't know what happened. He just got down there, went on vacation, and I think it was a family thing or something. He just said, nah. I'm not even coming back to get my stuff to ship it to me. I'm
wow.
done.
Wow.
But, you know, the inner governmental works really didn't affect us that much. I mean, the only thing it might have affected was budgetary, you know, at times. But sometimes you'd get one guy in there and you'd have it all planned out. And then you get a new person in there, and they'd have a totally idea of how things should be ran. Like, no, you don't need this. You don't need to do this. I want you to do this instead. But I was low enough on the ladder that it didn't really affect me that much.
Well, with the trail crew, did that happen? And were there frustrations with that? Or
not really, because they pretty much listened to us. I mean, John had his own ideas, but a lot of times we'd all, you know, the three of us sit down, we could talk it out and then come to a mutual agreement how we should be doing something or what needed to be done. But even him, pretty much, because he'd come up every now and then, you know, a couple times a year, season maybe, to just come up and do things or see it. Clay would do the same thing. But, you know, they pretty much trusted Watson and I to make the decisions and decide what needed to be done. You know, if we wanted to do a reroute, yes, we had to get permission from the archaeology, because we had to have the archaeology, the trail archaeology crew go through first, and then get permission from John and from Clay and all that. That's where we could do it.
Right.
Because we were veering off of what was the actual corridor course.
Right.
And, you know, I mean, nine times out of ten, they would realize what we were talking about. Like, okay, the trail's washing out here. You know, it's right against the river. The river's moving this way. We're going to lose this by mid-season next year. Then we'll be crunching to try to do a temporary reroute. Let's do it now before it happens. You know, so we always tried to get our ducks in a row first before we had to do something on an emergency thing.
And then budgetary-wise, did you always get what you needed? Or did you have to fight for a budget?
Not really, because, you know, the trail crew wasn't fighting against anybody else, and it was the Chilka Trail is a historic, important part of the Park Service. So we pretty much got what we wanted, you know, and when we wanted it. And they always were, you know, pretty generous with the budget.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we wouldn't, in the season, we wouldn't be down to nickels and pennies. We'd have money left over to buy equipment, and, mm-hmm. you know, for to use or lose. But, I mean, we wouldn't have tons of money. We never went over budget or had to. And then, you know, they always had contingency monies for something happening in the winter, like an avalanche or an unexpected flood taking something out that had to be addressed right away the next year. That got pushed through right away.
And then for the restoration projects, that budget was above your pay grade, I'm sure. You didn't have anything to do with that.
No, and like I say, they had the way it was originally done, and now don't hold me this because it could have changed through over the years. Congress, you know, and Department of Interior and the Park Service had set aside the amounts of money that they figured was going to cost to restore each of the buildings. And, of course, you know, as inflation goes and things change, and once you start actually getting into it, things change. So I'm sure they had flexibility in there for that stuff. And so, you know, I mean, I wasn't in the budgetary finance part of that, any of that aspect, but we never, I can think of or ever remember, we never got stopped once by progress because of lack of money or fundings.
Well, as you say, it also was a priority for the Park Service to get those buildings mm-hmm. maintained, so you think that would meant they had the money for it.
And, you know, you got to remember, too, a lot of those buildings are leased back, so as soon as they could get them done right, they could lease them back to the public and start
making
money, you know, paying. Because, you know, they have to, the park had to, whatever the going rate for square foot of retail lease space in Skagway is what the park has to go by. Mm-hmm. They can't undercut the private sector.
That's right.
So, like, you know, most of the buildings, I think, if I'm correct, like I say, I was just out of my realm too, or 5-year lease, 3 to 5 year leases, and then they renew them, or you look at them after that, and then if the cost of real estate has gone up, they have to readjust for that, just like anybody else.
Right. And then I know there's the whole regulations from the historic district about maintaining those buildings a certain way and all that, that they probably look at how the leaser is using the space as well, maybe.
Yeah, they do, and the Park Service always has one member of the HDC is always one of the upper people
right.
of the Park Service.
Right.
Park has a say in it, and the city, they kind of agree on it. And yeah, there's certain things that they don't want in those buildings because it just doesn't fit.
Right.
And, the colors got to be certain,
right.
There's one little store, it's a privately owned building on, would it be 3rd and Broadway, right across from the Golden North, next to the Sweet Tooth Cafe, going north. It's privately owned, and the guy, I can't remember if the guy that owned it either released it or he sold it, but these people come in and they paint this bright, godly gold, yellow, or I mean, it hurts your eyes to even look at when the sun hits it. And somehow
the historic commission allowed that?
Well, I don't know exactly what happened there. If it was an oversight on their part and they didn't realize the actual colors were going to be or what, but there was a lot of, that was just like 2 years ago when that happened.
Yeah.
Maybe, no, 3, because I was still working for the city. There was a lot of yelling about that, but it was too late. It was already done. They couldn't make them repaint it.
Oh. The other, quickly before we finish up, I appreciate all your time.
Oh, yeah.
Are you the Nelson family that has a connection to Nelson Slough?
No.
In Dyea? It's
no.
A different family.
There's, at one time, there was 3 different Nelsons and families, and Nelson Slough, I think, is before any of our families were there.
Okay.
That goes way back.
Okay.
Because, there was, yeah.
So your dad was the beginning of your Nelson family in Skagway.
Yeah.
Okay.
And then there was another individual, Sammy Nelson. He was a fisherman. And then Lee Nelson, who had 3 sons, whose one son was the guy that had the outfitters.
You said his, Wes, was that the guy? Is that what you said?
That was the son, yeah, Wes.
Wes, okay.
And he's gone now, too. He drowned in a boating accident.
Oh, that's too bad. And then you guys are the 3rd Nelsons.
Yeah.
And then I read that there was a Chuck Nelson who was one of the first Chilkoot Trail, I don't know if he was a ranger or a, I don't know if I have that. He's not a relation to you?
No.
Okay. Oh, here it is. What was he? '72. Yeah, he was one of the first Chilkoot Trail Rangers with the Park Service.
Okay, no, I don't know.
But it's not a relation.
No.
Okay.
No, that was right when they started to even do anything up there. I mean,
right.
They really had to start maintaining it, and I had '72. I was still in high school.
Yeah.
And
okay.
That was way before I even had an inclination I was going to go to work for the park.
Yeah, but when you were growing up, you went out into the woods. Did you and your friends? Did people, local people, go hiking out there, go out to Dyea?
Oh yeah, we spent because we used to have a little cabin out in Dyea, but we thought we were on state land. Us and there's like 4 or 5 other people. They were all kind of grouped. And lo and behold, when the Kapanskis sold the Poland property to the Park Service, when they resurveyed it, whoever surveyed it in the 50s had messed up. We were actually on the Poland property, not state property, so we all got kicked off.
You couldn't just move your cabin?
no place to move it to.
Oh.
Because we were right against the mountainside, right in the park, you know, just north of the, we were all on that road, you know where the Slight Cemetery is? Out in Dyea?
Sort of, I guess I've been past there because I've been to the trailhead.
Okay.
That's as far into Dyea as I've been.
Oh, if you've only been to the trail, you haven't been over down the flats.
No.
Okay, well, Slight Cemetery is over there against the West Mountain. And there's a road that goes north. Anyway, there was like four or five of us or families that had cabins back in that area, you know, but it wasn't, they thought at the time they were just off of the Pullen property.
Mm-hmm.
Pullen owned a lot, my Pullen owned quite a little bit of Dyea at one time.
Okay.
So when they resurveyed it anyway after the park bought it all, they found out that we were on there. There was no place to move it. You know, nobody really tried to fight because they knew, you know, it was a losing battle. My dad was already gone by that time, and I was working for the park, so I couldn't really contest it. So we got kicked off, and then like the Pattersons, when they sold their property to the park, they offered portions of it to the public, to the local people who did buy a bunch of it, like the Dermots, Calvics, the Hosfords, one of the Burnhams, and all bought, you know, like acre or two or whatever, you know, however size they were selling from the Patterson estate or the family before. And then after everybody, you know, bought what they wanted, you know, and I think the Pattersons gave the public, you know, local people a year or something like that. Then they turned around and sold the rest of their property to the park.
And so the Pullens could have done that. They could have.
Yeah, they just sold a lock, stock, and barrel. Everything.
And so those other families who had those cabins out there, who lost them with the resurvey, what was their reaction?
Oh, they were all, you know, some were pissed, but, you know, and then a couple of them that were there, they had moved on, had retired, you know, just like friends and all, or, you know, people were using it. A couple of them just like, yeah, okay, you know. I mean, they all realized that they didn't have a leg to stand on because it was a bad survey, I guess, to start with. And
yeah, I guess I wonder why the Park Service didn't sort of grandfather those in and let them be used.
I don't know.
You know, as inholdings.
Yeah, I.
But
don't ask me.
No, okay.
You know, I mean, I have no idea. That's that was a decision that probably wasn't even made on the local level. I'm sure that was a kid.
Yeah.
Way high
so,
up.
But when you were growing up and your family had that cabin, when would you go out there? What would you do out there?
We'd go out in the summer. We'd spend time out there. My mom always had a big garden out there because she was great gardener. I spent a lot of my summers out there, you know. We'd go out there for weeks at a time and just go out, play, hike around.
Fish? Was there fishing out there?
Not really. No. You know, I mean, you could fish in the river, but only when, like, the dollies were running and everything. But I really wasn't into fishing. I was more into just hiking and climbing the mountainside.
Did you go hunting?
I did a little bit, but my dad, by the time I was old enough to hunt, my dad was getting up there in years, so we really didn't do much hunting, and I like looking at live animals. I mean, I have nothing against hunting.
No.
I'm just not into it, you know.
Right.
I mean,
Well, and then so we know your dad worked for the White Pass. Your birth mother, did she work outside of the home, or she raised you guys?
No, she was just a homemaker.
And basically. Then your stepmom, what about her?
She worked a little bit as housekeeping at the Golden North, but she was more a homemaker, too, because she had a son and daughter, twins that were almost exactly
right.
just about a year and a month older than me. So they were kids, too.
Right. So she had her hands full with you guys. Yeah. And now is she the one who had the garden?
No.
No, that was your mom. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, I've heard Skagway's good for gardening.
Oh, yeah. It's great. Of course, me, I can't.
You didn't inherit.
I didn't inherit that. I inherited my dad's trait for pounding nails, yeah. Not my mom's trait for growing vegetables.
Yeah. Okay, well, is there anything else?
I can't think of anything. Pretty much covered my experiences with them, you know. I mean, I enjoyed it, you know, like I said, but.
Well, I have one more question, I guess, because you were thinking about, you know, you've talked about all these good people you worked with. Were there difficult times or challenging times with?
Well, there was always employees that were, yeah, I mean, not with necessarily with the supervision. I mean, John and I sometimes, and Watson and I, we didn't get along with him at times. But, you know, it was more, his ideas weren't quite what we wanted. He thought he knew everything. I really shouldn't say that because I like John, but yeah, you know, there was times you'd get a guy that looked good on paper, and you know, I mean, wound up not knowing anything or you know, lazy. But like with us, with the trail crew, once we got down to this, the four of us, we always had a pretty good crew because we had guys that come back for 3-4 years in a row, you know, okay. Or longer. And we were able to pick our own crew.
Yeah.
We didn't get, you know, we just didn't get told here, this is who you're going to hire.
Right.
But it's like any other place, you know. Yeah, they're going to, especially in the higher echelon, they're going to want to get somebody that just wants to get rid of somebody, but they can't fire him. So they're going to tell you how great of a guy he is,
right.
You know, a person he is, male or female, just to get you to hire him, you know, so he can transfer over, and then you find
right.
out this guy isn't worth anything.
Yeah. Well, when you were working on the trail crew, it probably was all men.
Yeah.
But nowadays, it's mixed?
It's mixed. There's one female. First year, Watson was here. His trail crew, the two laborers he had were both women.
And what year would that have been?
That would have been 1980. Let's see. 81.
Okay. Wow, that's pretty early.
Yeah.
And then the restoration crew, were there women involved in that?
We had a couple women. We had one, Elsie, that actually stayed on. Lisa Cassidy is her real name. And she's working at the Presidio now. But she came in. She was laborer. And then she went to back east to some woodworking school and everything one winter, and learned how to do some woodworking and painting and all. So she came back to the park. This is after we were all riffed. And she was working maintenance and being one of their painters. And then we had Eve Griffin, who started off as an archaeologist, and then she wound up being a painter for the park, and she worked there, I don't know what years, but she finally wound up, she had to quit to go back because her mom had gotten ill back in North Carolina, so she left a couple years ago to take care of her mom. And quite a few female archaeologists, of
yeah,
course.
Yeah, right.
Doreen had, one time she had two women and a guy, and then she seemed to always have at least one female on her
yeah.
crew.
Well, hopefully, maybe you'll catch Doreen yeah. if you guys go back up to Coldfoot. Maybe I catch her next summer.
Yeah.
Because it would be fun to hear her experiences as an archaeologist.
Oh, yeah. I know she'd love it. She's very intelligent. She knows more of the history. I mean, I was born and raised in Skagway. She knows more about the whole history of that in Alaska than I do, but then that's part of her job.
Right, you know. Right. But it's do you think Skagway was a good place to grow up?
Oh, yeah. I enjoyed it. You know, I mean, I couldn't, well, I can't say for any, you know, everybody, but I enjoyed it. I liked it. I can't see myself having grown up in a big city, you know, because, well, I have never had the experience, so I wouldn't know what it was like. But I liked, I've always liked being in the outdoors, you know, being outside, hiking, camping, and, yeah, for me, it was perfect, you know.
And being in a small town was okay?
Yeah, I had no problem.
Well, you know everybody.
Yeah, everybody knows you, everybody knows each other's business.
Right.
That's the only bad thing is, you know, you can't get away with too much in a small town.
Yeah.
But, no, it was good. And, you know, growing up, everybody looked out for each other, you know, and still do, you know. People live there year-round. Somebody's sick or needs help, everybody pitches in. You know,
nice.
One way or not everybody, you know, there's always help there. Like my, when Pat got sick with the ALS, he was just trying to do some remodeling on his house and add on a beauty shop because his wife was the local Skagway beautician, you know, hairstylist
right.
there. A lot of the guys from the Park Service went in after hours on weekends and day offs and helped Pat get his place done.
Nice.
And then my wife, or my my niece, the mother, then my niece, then my grandniece is living here, going to school here. Her husband died from ALS too, about 5 years after Pat did.
Oh.
They were both about the same age, mid 40s, and their house needed work and needed like a handicap room and everything mm-hmm. for Luke. Town pitched in, the contractors pitched in.
Nice.
They had it redone within a week.
Wow, nice.
You know, it just kicked in like that. People that are financially strapped or have some major medical bills that don't have any insurance or any, you know, are hurting for money for some way reason, you know, like be it cancer or major medical incidents. There's always fundraisers that go on.
What, you said there's the jars that are out, and they have auctions and all kinds of things.
Oh, yeah, the Elks and the Eagles will put on functions, you know, they'll have a dinner or a dance and stuff like that. And then the Elks, during the winter, on Fridays, they have the hamburger feed, and it's for the school kids for different groups.
Oh, right.
You know, be it maybe
basketball
boys,
trip.
Basketball, track. DDF, you know.
What's DDF?
It's debate.
Oh.
Drama, debate, and forensics. It's like a debate thing. In fact, Kara, my niece is here. She won state year before last in DDF for
cool.
her presentation on ALS, and she went to the nationals.
Good deal.
So, yeah, there's always stuff that goes on there. And so
nice.
That's what makes it special, too.
Yeah, nice. All right, well, thank you very much.
Took up
a lot of your time today.
Oh,
I appreciate
right.
it. And
well, no problem. I just got to wait for an airplane.
Okay.